Connection is a fundamental need for human beings. It's a physical and mental medicine, it's an evolutionary advantage, and it's part of a life well lived. But it's also awkward, and it's hard, and in today's world, you can opt out of it entirely if you want to. But not today! I'm making the bold assumption that you're all here because you care about connection or well-being or safe spaces. And so to start us off, I would love for you to turn to the nearest person you don't know and introduce yourself. Don't be shy. Well done, everyone. Thank you for indulging me. My name is Katie. And now that we're all acquainted and friends, we can settle into our evening, and I can officially welcome you to Floating Space Live. Okay, so whether you are here from the podcast or just stumbled through the door or someone dragged you here, tonight we are gathered to continue our hunt for the third place. So sociologist Ray Oldenburg suggested everybody needs three places in their lives. Your first place is your home, your second place is your workplace, and your third place is somewhere neutral, a place you can gather easily, inexpensively, regularly, and pleasurably. Somewhere neutral you can socialize, interact, and just be. So tonight's search, we are looking through the past, the present, and the future. We are incredibly lucky to have not one, but two very special guests. We have London's Deputy Mayor for Communities and Social Justice, Dr. Debbie Weeks-Bernard. And we also have journalist, social commentator, and community organizer extraordinaire, Shante Joseph. But before we get into all of that, first, a walk back through season one.
Previously on Floating Space.
I definitely know that my world feels a lot smaller.
No one has time, no one has money. We're even more acutely aware that these third places have gone.
I mean, the conduit is really a quintessential third space.
I used to call this place home from home. Like,
I think it's really easy to vilify online spaces as not being real enough.
That I know they're not online friends anymore. They're the closest friends that I have.
Places like this are places where you can grow into a young adult, basically, and then go forth as a confident queer.
I mean, I think there's a lot of freedom in the dark.
The kind of unpredictability and like the breadth of experience that you can have in nature works as a third space. It's not another space that has rules.
So each episode was a lesson in community or social values or a lens into society. And I wanted everything to be so jam-packed and tight that the clips that you're going to hear now were really valuable, didn't quite make the narrative. So here's a peek behind episode one, where I spoke to Celine, the show's resident architect.
Oldenburg, he talks about third places being a leveler. So that means it's a place where anyone of social or economical background could come and gather. And with these coffee shops and eateries and pubs and bars, they, depending on what they are, they're just absolutely not for a certain type of people. You know, you could be dressed the wrong way. You could be talking the wrong way. You just look wrong. You wouldn't fit into the ambiance that is very much designed into these types of places. So they definitely curate it. And there's a good quote by Sharon Zukin. She's an American sociologist, and she wrote an essay called The Culture of Cities. And she basically describes gentrification of third places as a consumable vision of civility. And it's just absolutely, it's correct, right? It's making what true third places could be into something that's marketable, consumable, and something to make money off, when a true third place, as Oldenburg describes it, just should be that all. It should be something that's accessible to everybody.
So third places as a marketing tool. I'm sure everybody has been to a place where the aesthetic is impeccable. The walls match the lampshade that match the plants that match the seats. But just because a space uses the right copy or the right terminology, third place gym, £200, no affiliation. It doesn't mean that it's a third place. And so Celine points out that more and more spaces are being gentrified, but also the concept of community is being gentrified. And increasingly, you see brands that are hijacking the word community, offering an antidote to loneliness with their spaces or clubs, when in fact all they want is your image or your money or your attention. And I think it's just important to remember that while you're thinking about the spaces that you want to contribute to and spend time in, think about what those spaces are trying to get from you as well. So let's move on to Private Members Clubs, episode 2, where I spoke to Paul, the CEO of the Private Members Club, The Conduit, about what they look for in their members.
My theory of The Conduit is you have to have a founding genome and you have to have a founding ethos. And then you have to be selective in how you constitute that genome and that ethos. And then you have to program to it and cater to it and allow people to interact. But in some ways, it's like a sourdough starter.
They're
fragile and delicate, and you have to, but once they start, they bubble up, right? And they constantly replicate themselves, and you can scoop off some of that sourdough starter and you can give it to someone else and they can go and make their own sourdough. And every morning it froths up. And that's because you've set a culture and a community and a membership that self-replicates because it attracts people like it. And by self-replicate, I don't mean, you know, an echo chamber of mono-thought wokery. You know, that you don't want. You don't want that because that's boring itself. What you want is a group of people who can disagree passionately without being disagreeable, who recognize that the world is complex, that there aren't easy answers, that there are trade-offs between many of the things that we're seeking to achieve, and who are comfortable with and willing to embrace that complexity. And that, I think, is a stimulating place to be. You know, that's like sourdough. But I think that replication, if you do it well, happens organically.
So third places as unifiers, not fragmenters. And my conversation with Paul was one of my favorites of the season because, one, he's very clearly a very interesting, knowledgeable man who's lived many lives as a human rights lawyer, a businessman, and now a founder. But he also truly believed in what he was building at The Conduit. And Paul's theory of a sourdough starting genome was one that I totally understand. I agree that spaces should be a space to discuss social change and the world, and that's valuable and a fundamental part of what a third place is. But I suppose it got me thinking about the curation of spaces. Who decides what merits or values are useful to a space? And does this process of curation do more to unify us? Or does it fragment a space that's supposed to be for belonging? So let's take a look at episode 3. Shakira, a former Roundhouse resident artist.
The Roundhouse was able to facilitate creatives who didn't need to know that they needed to be in each other's space. But once that relationship was formed, we're like, yo, like, this is beyond the art itself. Like, this, I love that I've met you. I love that we can now connect and create things together and challenge things together, you know, in the outside world through what we're making together. As uncomfortable as it can be, like the challenges, you know, if it's creative challenges or whatever the challenges are, to be in that space is where you grow, isn't it? And being able to, in inverted commas, make mistakes or just try things out for the sake of trying things out is really important, I think. And that's what you can do here. There's a lot of pressure we can put on ourselves otherwise or feel from other people. And actually, the importance of a space like this, just to try, just to experiment, just to go, cool, I gave it a go, it wasn't for me. Or I gave it a go and I didn't know it was for me, but it's now. Yeah, let's go, let's run with it. So it's a space that allows patience. For you to be patient with yourself, and others will just naturally be patient with you because that's the setup. And it's true that I just don't think there are as many places like that as there should be, maybe.
So third places as safe spaces. And I'm so happy with how this episode turned out because I think it captured exactly what I wanted it to, which is finding a space for young people to try and to fail. But more than that, it got me thinking about being an adult and growing older and having those spaces to try and fail, and that there aren't that many, but that to grow, we all need to continue to do that and to meet people that, whether it's in a small or large capacity, will be there to pick you up or not judge you or be patient with you. And so I'm not just saying this because we're at the Roundhouse, but I think it is a really special place as you're a young person and as you grow older to continue to contribute to the community and be a part of it. And so I want to leave you with the question from this episode of thinking about where you spend your time and can you fail and will your community pick you back up? So on to episode 4, which is Bell Hawkins, our online expert.
I also wonder if comfort has something to do with it. Like, we can live a very comfortable life when we're extremely online. And by that, I mean, like, I've just been sick for 2 weeks and haven't got dressed properly because I've just been inside, you know, and you can do it all from your bed and you can arrange your space in your house so it's comfortable for you. And I think we've gotten so used to that, that anything slightly challenging or tricky or bright or harsh is sort of heightened. As you get older, you specialize more in your life, and so you get more and more used to being good at things and less used to being bad at things.
So third places as stimulators. And comfort is the enemy of growth, and inconvenience is the price of community were quotes that swirled around in my head. And we'll get to this later with Shantae, because she's definitely spoken about that. But talking to the brilliant Bell Hawkins just made me think about the balance of community. And Ray Oldenburg's third place theory fit very much into the 15-minute city ideal, that things should be convenient and close and right on your doorstep. But that convenience doesn't write off effort. So for connection, you will pay. You will either pay with money and spend time in maybe a third, a private members club, or you will pay with inconvenience. You'll pay with your time, your effort, your thought, and your bravery showing up, contributing to someone or some place. And so after 50 hours, you might come away with an acquaintance. After 90 hours, you might come away with a good friend. And after 200 hours, you'll come away with a close friend, according to psychology professor Jeffrey Hall. So you reap what you sow. And that's so funny to quantify into 200 hours. So on to episode 5, we have Lucia, the founder of nightclub Donya.
I think more could be done in terms of recognizing nightlife for the service that it provides, in the same way that we recognize museums and theaters and, you know, landmarks. I think like nightclubs should be the same, you know, like they are the starting point of a lot of points of progress for our society. You know, you look at a lot of movements, they've started in the night. Like, we need to at least afford these businesses leeway to have a hard month and get through it. Because for a lot of businesses, you know, if you have a hard month, you're out and the money isn't good. So you've got to care about it. Yeah, I think that they should be seen as something that is a force of social benefit, and it should be recognized in that way.
So third places as cultural pillars. This episode really meant a lot because it resulted in something tangible. What I didn't understand about nightlife communities, because I'm not really a part of any, was not only the individual transformation that happens, but it's the history of collective action and movements and starting something really important on the fringes of society. And this episode was a real reminder that all voices are important, and that if you care about a space, even if it's not yours, if you know that it's important to a certain community around you, write to your counsellor, write to your MP and say something, because every voice matters. And a final note on this episode, which is also preserve joy. I wish I added so many clips from founder John Nolan of The Divine, because he was so funny and sweet and bubbly. But I couldn't. So I thought I would just add one here.
It's fantastical, isn't it? It's not real. It's the third place again, isn't it? It's not a practical place. You're not here to do anything other than present a version of yourself that you want to present. You know, it's fantasy. Dancing is freedom.
So on to episode 6, the outdoor space. And this is with poet Ayari from The Pockets Project, which looked at South London community gardens.
There's so much learning that can be done. Even things like this concept of fallow, that like it's like an agricultural term or something. It's basically when you rest the soil so that you're not like overburdening it, because if you grow stuff in soil like too many times without giving it a rest, then like the plants won't survive and it won't be vitamin rich and mineral rich and stuff. And that teaches us so much about how like you can't keep going nonstop, you know, like you have to take time to rest, and you have to take time where you don't have goals or a destination and you're just like, oh, I'm existing, I'm resting. And like, even if you're being like, I need to sell my potatoes to Sainsbury's, even then you have to pay attention to that. But on a more like normal scale, rest is important. You can actually learn that from soil. So
third place is for rest. And we did only talk about South London community gardens. There's no North-South war here. Just happened to be that way. But living in London can really feel like a pressure cooker. And so I know I felt from time to time leaving was a relief. But this episode and talking to the Pockets Project really reminded me of what grows and lives within the London M25. And that communities are conserving the pockets of green that live and thrive here. And so getting your fingers dirty in the winter, in the cold, in the wet, like today, is really important. And that third places are for all year round, not just for fair weather friends. So I loved exploring London through the eyes and the people and the places that made it so unique and special and care for it all year round. So it seemed only fitting to have someone come on who also thinks about and cares for London all year round. Can I have a huge round of applause for Deputy Mayor for Communities and Social Justice, Dr. Debbie Weeks-Bernard. Thank you for joining, Debbie. How are you feeling?
Feeling okay. It's a bit daunting.
So I'm going to start off with asking you the question that I asked everyone. Do you have a third place?
So this was a really difficult thing to think about, largely because I don't have any time to go to third places. Don't tell my boss. So the one place that I do go to quite a bit is, and given everything that you've just said about expensive gyms, I do go to the gym. But the reason that it is my third space is because during the pandemic, when we all spent all of our time inside, when the gyms and the community centres were able to open up, I flocked to mine, and I joined a really wonderful exercise class filled with women of a certain age, like myself, who just would go to an exercise class every single week and have enormous fun. It's just one of those places where these were women from a variety of different socioeconomic backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. Some of them had literally left a pot of rice on and run up to the and I know I shouldn't say that, run up to the to the community centre, which was literally around the corner. Exercise class, 45 minutes back to get back to finish cooking. And it was just a wonderful way to bond with women who just wanted to get together to exercise, but also just the endorphins that you get from exercising when you've had a really difficult period of time is just wonderful. So my third space, unfortunately, is a gym.
Not unfortunately, we love gyms and we visited them as well. So that's totally fine and acceptable. So you spend a lot of time in different communities and visiting different places. Can you just tell us a bit more about what you do in your position as for communities and social justice?
Sure, yes. So one of the areas of responsibility that I have, I mean, I have communities in my title, is to try to bring the voice of the many disparate communities we have in London into our decision-making and our policy-making, and to make sure that whenever we try to develop an initiative, that it's really meeting the needs of all of our communities. And it's not an easy task. We have nearly 9 million people in London, and there are 300 languages spoken in our city. And those languages represent communities from not only a range of different backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, but from different parts of the UK. London is a magnet for people who want to come to a place where they will feel welcome, but also a place where they can be themselves. And we also have a huge proportion of people born outside of the UK. So we try as much as we can to develop programs and policies that ensure that everyone has as positive as they can an experience of our city. And that will mean making sure that we boost our community centres and our volunteering community and charitable sector. That will mean making sure that we consult widely whenever we come up with a policy idea. But also it means recognising that whilst we have so many communities, not all of those communities have an equal experience of our city. And there are some that are more vulnerable than others, and there are some that are more disadvantaged than others. And sometimes what that means is that you have to prioritise those communities above others. And I do spend an awful lot of time trying to make sure that I'm making those sorts of connections.
So, okay, let's look at that more specifically, because we've spoken already about communities, community building by communities, as we've spoken in the recap. So what does that actually look like from a policy standpoint? As you said, some people need more care, more attention than others, and more support. So what's your role, or the government's, local government's role in building those communities and being involved?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I'll give you one example. So if you consider that London's this city, which is, it's one of the wealthiest cities in the world, right? It's one of the wealthiest cities in the UK, but we've got one of the highest child poverty rates in the whole of the UK, which is shocking and startling. And there are certain parts of our city where the rates of child poverty are much higher than others, so certain boroughs. And one of the things that we have realised is that often in London, those who are most likely to need help are least likely to ask for it. And what we can't do as decision makers is wait for people to come to us to ask for help. So we have to actively seek communities where they're at. So one of the things that we sought to do when it comes to trying to address poverty. Poverty is ultimately about making sure that people have enough to get by. It's about making sure that you put cash into people's pockets. And there are lots of people who probably are eligible for all sorts of things, all sorts of pots of cash, all sorts of benefits and forms of support. Loads of people living in debt. And all they really need is to have access to someone who will take them by the hand, who will look at all of those unopened letters that they will have, and help them to find out the source of their financial difficulty, and because we know that those most likely to live in poverty, least likely to ask for it, tend to be from some of our racialized minorities, tend to be those who've got insecure migration status. We've got a great advice sector in London, Citizens Advice, wonderful body. And we decided to just place advisors, debt advisors, people to give advice on all sorts of issues inside community centres, inside faith organisations, so inside mosques, synagogues, inside food banks, etc. Because we know that our community-based organisations are trusted implicitly by the people who see them every day, who see themselves recognised when they go to the reception. And as a result of us doing something as simple as putting somebody with a bit of experience and knowledge on how to avoid debt inside a community centre, we were able to put so much money back into people's pockets. So that's both about realising that we've got a really strong, vibrant, trusted, wonderful community and voluntary sector, and to give them what they need to be able to help the people who do trust them and who come to them for all sorts of reasons. And that's what we do to try to build our communities, support the infrastructure that supports the communities so that communities can come in and out and feel that their local community centre gives them more than just perhaps a cup of tea, a bit of shelter, but also gives them advice, helps them to avoid debt, but also helps them to make connections with other people.
Yeah, so a real hub and making sure it's multi-purpose. Yeah. I'm really glad you brought up community centres as well, because, you know, all we see in headlines and all everyone can talk about is that a lot of these community centres are closing, and that's also a reality. It's not just community centres, it's youth centres. And so with that kind of shuttering of the budget, or maybe some people in positions of power don't feel that they're as valuable as perhaps maybe the community believe they are, what is the mayor's office doing to protect them? And if not protect them, then making sure that there are still spaces for people to congregate, connect, and access all of the help that you've spoken about.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've mentioned the pandemic before, but I think during that period of time, it's when a lot of people from a range of layers of government and elsewhere realised how much our charities and our community centres do for people. I'm sure everyone will remember all of those individuals who came out of their homes and started delivering prescriptions and food. And they were doing that because, I mean, ultimately, I believe that everyone's really good at heart. But also because they could see that without those centres in the spaces that people might have ordinarily used, because they were all shut down, that you had to actively go out there and do something to support people who were feeling vulnerable, but who also were feeling very isolated. And during that period, we could tell that there were lots of cultural buildings, lots of creative organisations, all of those places that would have relied on income, whatever shape or form, for them to keep going, who were then closed, who couldn't get access to that income, couldn't pay their rent, and those places were at risk. We set up something called the Cultural Spaces at Risk Programme, and that was basically about helping cultural spaces. And a lot of those cultural spaces would be, sometimes spaces like this, spaces where you would come to go and see a play, places where you would go perhaps because it was allowed you to have working space, for example, but that you would pay to access it, gyms, all of them, you name it. We made sure that those organisations had what they needed to just remain open. Sometimes that meant working with local authorities and with developers, just trying to create the opportunity for there to be just some breathing space for them so that they could operate once the lockdown was lifted. But also, I think for some spaces, helping them to think about how to adapt the service that they provide. So one of the things that we also did was, I have responsibility for community sport, and we've got a great grassroots sports sector here in London. And lots of young people, because you mentioned youth clubs, lots of young people who would have ordinarily been able to go and kick a football around on a Thursday, or to learn a new sporting skill, or just be able to come to a space to be with other people, were completely cut off from that during that pandemic. And what we needed to be able to do was to help some of those organisations whose very existence was based on face-to-face contact, to just be able to adapt their service a little bit during that period of time so that they could continue functioning. So sometimes that meant helping them to gain access to things that they probably didn't have that much of, like lots of laptops. Sometimes that just meant them being able to find ways to engage with young people who would have phones but wouldn't have access to credit. So making sure that we worked with sporting organisations but also with funders so that they could support all of these organisations to do their jobs differently, in a different way, but still are now allowed them to be able to engage with the young people who they needed to engage with. Because it was really clear, I think, to everybody that particularly vulnerable groups of people who found themselves indoors for a long period of time, if they were in a home that was loving and safe and warm, that was fine. But there were some and many young people who were in environments that were not safe and for whom often their coach or their youth worker was providing them with a lifeline. And so we needed to ensure that we gave those coaches and those youth workers what they needed to effectively, in certain circumstances, just save lives. And it's something that, you know, I'm deeply humbled by the way that people can just adapt what they're doing at the drop of a hat. There's so much innovation in our charitable organisations and in our youth organisations. And I know that there were so many young people, as well as people from a range of ages, but particularly young people who during that period of time would have been given a lifeline that they might not have received otherwise.
I think you are absolutely bang on about spaces being multifaceted. And definitely when I spoke to John Nolan from The Divine, their new space is, you know, in the daytime, it's a puppetry workshop for South Asian women's communities. It's a rehearsal space. And then in the evening, they have a club night. They have all of these different things. And that's kind of an essential part of business now to keep those spaces alive and filled for the whole time. And so I understand what you're saying about adapting your service, adapting your space and welcoming different groups and being a lifeline for not just young people, but maybe the elderly and all of those spaces as well. So I want to make sure we talk about the Love and Wanted campaign, which I believe is a newly announced £900,000 investment into communities. So can you just briefly talk about what those spaces are and what and who it's for?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So this year, Valentine's Day, we launched a campaign called Loved and Wanted because we're lovey-dovey that way. And it was Loved and Wanted is a campaign that we launched in the wake of the riots that took place last summer as a result of the murder of those two little girls in Stockport and the violence that erupted in other parts of the country. And whilst we didn't see that level of damage and disorder in London, and I'm sure there are people in the room that will remember all of those individuals who came out to certain parts of London, like Walthamstow, which is down the road from where I live, to say, you know, we don't stand for hatred here. Even though we know that a lot of that didn't happen here, there is still a lot of fear in our communities. There is still a lot of worry in our communities. There are a lot of mums whose children no longer go to after-school clubs as a result of what happened last summer because they're still so afraid. And what we wanted to do with this campaign was to send out a clear message that in London, which is a city which prides itself on its diversity, if you are from any background, any protected characteristic, you will be loved and wanted here. You will be supported, you will be respected, you'll be valued. And so what we've done is we've set up a fund so that we can set up 15 spaces around London. And they'll almost be like beacons, like spaces of sanctuary, as it were. Spaces that are providing a range of different services throughout the day, so like hubs, but who are interested in opening up their doors to communities that they might not ordinarily open their doors to, because ultimately at the basis of what we're seeking to do is to build cohesion. And we know that the issue of racial hatred is on the rise. Many of you will have seen 150,000 people came to the streets of London in September under the Unite the Kingdom banner, and that there is a lot of anti-migrant, Islamophobic, there's a lot of hatred circulating at the moment. And what we want to seek to do with these spaces is to counter that. Because the issue with racism and racial hatred is that it seeks effectively to isolate people. So all of those mums whose children are no longer going to after-school clubs, etc., it works to make your world smaller. So somebody was mentioning that in one of your podcasts. It makes your world smaller. It isolates you because it makes you frightened to leave your home and go out. And what we really want these spaces and this campaign to do is to enable people to identify places where they will feel safe, where they will feel warm and welcomed, and to send that really clear message that even though racial hatred and divisive narratives really seek to stop people from being able to connect, in London, we operate on connection, and we want to make sure that this big, wonderful city is as open as it is as possible to people from any background, regardless of where they're from. So the fund, we announced it a few weeks ago. We closed to applications on Sunday. We'll be announcing the grantees on Valentine's Day next year.
Very romantic.
Yes, I know. And it's just all, I think everything that we seek to do in London is just to send that really important message of unity and of common humanity. My boss, Sadiq Khan, many of you will know, seems to irritate the leader of the free world often, just by his very existence. And whilst we joke about it, it does mean that sometimes we then attract all sorts of attention, and the attention that we attract isn't always positive. In fact, it's very negative often. But regardless of that negative attention, we always stand on the side of those who feel fearful, and we stand on the side of those who often feel as though their very existence is being questioned, their very presence in this country is being questioned. And so for as long as, you know, I'll be deputy mayor, if you're from any background, any protected characteristic, this will be a city that's for you, definitely.
And can people contact you? Can people reach out and seek help or guidance or anything?
Oh, completely, yes. I have an email address.
Oh my gosh, she's got an email address.
I have an email address. Yes, please do. I mean, we are incredibly open at the GLA. We've got lots and lots of contact information for anyone that wants to find out about the program. But also, you know, I've got teams who work for me who are set up to provide that support to, it could be a charitable organisation, a community-based organisation, or indeed just an individual who wants to find out more about what we do, but also just wants to find out more about how we can ensure that they feel as welcome in this city as they need to. We are public servants. We exist to serve. So if anyone wants to get in touch, please do get in touch. We are available.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Debbie. Thank you for coming in and sharing your time. Round of applause for Debbie, please.
Thank you for listening to part one of Floating Space Live. I want to say a huge thank you to Dr. Debbie Weeks-Bernard and her team from the Mayor of London's office. In part two, I'll be speaking with Shantay Joseph.
I am constantly surrounded by people. I don't want to be, but like I am. I have found it difficult at times to balance it. And this is partly why I was like, I need to start something that feels IRL. And we run an event series across London. It's called Strangers in the City.
That's next time on Floating Space.